Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Has the news in 2021 already made it feel like the bottom is falling out of your world? Well, what won't help that is your own bottom falling out of anything, so you may as well pop it into something comfortable, and while you're on the edge of your seat watching the state of things, at least that seat will feel real, real snug. British boxers make classic and crazily comfy underwear and loungewear, from knickers to slippers, dressing gowns to PJs, boxers, face masks and, even dog bandanas. Well, dog's got a lounge too, right? British boxers manufacture all their products with minimal waste, all environmentally friendly like, and pay all their workers properly for creating them too. Basically, they're a properly nice, ethically sound bunch, and my own butt would sing their praises, but let's be fair, no one wants to hear that on a podcast. Check out their range at british-boxers.com, and as a listener to the Partly Political Broadcast, and if you use the code PARPOLBRO15 when you check out, you'll get a sweet 15% off too. Yes, that's right, I'm now in the pockets of Big Pajama, and honestly, I couldn't be more comfortable. I'll keep this brief, because that's also what they make, so head to british-boxers.com, because not everything has to be pants in a bad way. Hello and welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, the comedy politics podcast that, like the national insurance rise, everyone will benefit from it, even though unfortunately only listeners have to bear the debilitating cost. I'm Tiernan Duya, but this week, as the government insists there are no plans for an October lockdown, well, of course there aren't. I mean, they don't have plans for anything. Hell, the Prime Minister can't even plan children. The pandemic is over, everyone! Woohoo! Though, probably best to give it a few months before the celebrations on account of all the constantly rising infection rates. Sorry, I mean it's done! Yeah, COVID is over. Stop looking at those numbers. That is clearly just the dying dregs of a virus fighting a losing battle. Because by ignoring that 30,000 or more people are still catching it every day, it's only moments till coronavirus dies, having been starved the oxygen of publicity. I am certain that is how germs work, based on cheese dreams I've had. Out of the 51,281 deaths over the first 6 months of this year, only 256 people were fully vaccinated. So, as we all know, that means it's their fault for not being willing to work with the vaccine, and it's that sort of hostile attitude that just doesn't help the country. As for the other 51,225 people, the less said about them, the better, right? Mainly so that no one notices that it's still an absolute David Cameron-sized shedload of dead people. Still, at least all the victims of COVID are being honoured by the government treating them with the same care and attention they did when they were alive. So, what with COVID being over, stop looking at the numbers, stop it. It's now time for the government to repeal parts of the Coronavirus Act so that they're no longer responsible for all the things they've barely pretended to be responsible for over the last 17 months. By the time you hear this, the Prime Minister, you know, like if a trumpet was caught up in tumbleweed, Boris Johnson, will repeal the authorities' powers to detain infectious people, which will mean that they no longer have to impose fines on all those people they couldn't find anyway due to a failing track and trace system. 300,000 people may have broken quarantine rules, but this way, no one will have to check anymore like they weren't already, so that is a massive relief. There will no longer be restrictions imposed on numbers attending events and gatherings, so it's great news to hear all the horse racing and other sports events can increase their numbers to exactly the same as they've been having since March 2020. And the government will now no longer have powers to allow the closing down of the economy. Though that may be because Brexit implications are doing that anyway, so it no longer needs the government kicking it to make sure it's dead as well. Sorry, I say Brexit, I mean of course the pandemic, which is over apart from the unfortunate way that it's affecting all the supply routes that would otherwise be affected by Brexit, but you know, aren't, because it's definitely the pandemic that isn't happening anymore. Now stop asking silly questions, God, you're so annoying. No, the government looking at possibilities of delaying border checks on EU goods for a second time isn't because of Brexit, it's because COVID has somehow managed to tamper with workforce availability and Brexit trade restrictions all at once, while simultaneously not being around anymore. I'm not sure what kind of complicated variant this new one is, but I can only assume it won't even have a letter of the Greek alphabet to describe it, because that won't be able to arrive from Europe in time. Vaccine passports have been scrapped too, which is obviously bad news for the vaccine, who's been working so hard this last year it really deserves a holiday. No one really wanted a vaccine passport on any side of the political spectrum, well, apart from a few ardent Brexiteers who'd have snaffled several each if they'd been blue. But it's not for any of the sensible discriminatory or data concerns that the plan hasn't gone ahead, but because, as the health secretary, and what happens when a child sticks googly eyes on items in the fruit bowl, Sajid Javid, what he said was we shouldn't be doing things for the sake of it. So I guess that means none of their friends could have overcharged for providing the service badly, so it just wasn't worth doing. Would vaccine passports give the Conservative an electoral advantage? Nah, not like forcing through voter ID despite only 6 cases of voter fraud in the 2019 election. So frankly, vaccine passports would be a big waste of money of the kind the Conservatives don't like, as it hasn't gone on like stables or a castle or something. A week ago, the vaccines minister and horsewoman, Nadeem Zawahi, said vaccine passports would be the best way to keep the night industry open, so that's probably why they've decided it wasn't worth it, as it'd only make it harder for cabinet ministers to fly around at night and drink people's blood if there were loads and loads of revelers around. The scheme will be kept in reserve in case it is needed over autumn or winter, meaning that it'll almost certainly happen around November as an overnight decision, making it hard to implement and super costly before venues fork out millions, only to be told 3 days later that they must shut down for a total lockdown as the next variant of COVID is 50 foot high and actively eating anyone who goes outside. Number 10 still says vaccine passports are the first line of defence against a winter wave of COVID, which must be why they're scrapping them, as being prepared like that is kind of against their brand. The Scottish Government are definitely having vaccine passports, though, for over 18s to enter nightclubs or big events from October, but that is quite smart as it means everyone will really be able to enjoy their night knowing for sure there won't be any Conservatives there. It has been approved for one dose of vaccine to be offered to 12 to 15 year olds, but I'm not sure how they're going to decide which one of them gets it, or if it'll just be given away in a Hunger Games style situation. The chief medical officer said it would reduce disruption to education to vaccinate teenagers, but based on the day I got my BCG vaccination, I reckon it'll actually make everything worse as all the kids just go around punching each other where you got the injection instead of paying any attention. Of course, there won't be any disruption to education as the pandemic is over, isn't it? But just in case, the Prime Minister will also be repealing the power to temporarily close or restrict access to schools, so even if everyone in the classroom is vomiting green bile and floating to the ceiling while speaking in tongues, that lesson will still have to go ahead. At least pupils will really be able to learn about biology if they can witness exactly how a virus gets around a poorly ventilated room and which immune systems can manage to deal with it. Education Secretary and Dog Nord refresher bar Gavin Williamson said he'll move heaven and earth to avoid shutting schools again, which seems unlikely as he appears to be the sort of person who struggled to move a cushion without fucking it up. Last week he told a newspaper that he'd met with footballer and actual leader of the opposition Marcus Rashford over Zoom, but it turned out that he'd actually had a meeting with rugby player Mario Itoje, who is also black and has been campaigning for laptops for schools. I know you're all thinking it's an obvious sign of racism or incompetence, or likely and definitely, in fact definitely, both, but credit to the education secretary, he's barely aware of who he is or what he does for a living, so it's hardly a surprise. Later that same week, Williamson addressed a university's conference via video call as he couldn't attend in person, and then he insisted that they all had to return to face-to-face teaching. I suggest they all just tell him he spoke to a completely different conference, and so they have absolutely no idea of what he said. The pandemic is over, but because of the ongoing pandemic that isn't happening, and not years of austerity, why would you even mention that? Why would anyone say that? There is increased pressure on the care system, which is why you, yes you, have to pay for it. The Prime Minister announced a rise in national insurance in order to pay for social care. Well, eventually, once it stops paying for the NHS, which would have been funded by the £350 million extra from Brexit that bus told us about. But then COVID, which isn't happening anymore, is still happening. So the Brexit money that wasn't there now has been there, but they didn't tell you about it, you know, in case, you know, you thought about it too much. And now it's not there, so open your wallets. Thanks. Please open them. Thanks. By rising taxes, the Conservatives have broken their manifesto promise not to. But if you'd assume that their last manifesto was anything other than a list of noises that when said out loud attract Tory voters like a mating call and a tub of pheromones during breeding season, then more fool you. You might remember, or probably not, that it now feels like it was 400 years ago. Their manifesto was one of the last ones to be revealed during the election campaign on account of their whole thing just being about getting Brexit done, which they also haven't managed to do. If we'd had any sort of time-travelling machine, you'd be able to go back to 2019 and use that manifesto as a bleak version of the Grey Sports Almanac, where you could put bets on absolutely everything it says in there not happening and win enough money to not have to pay any extra national insurance and get a free peerage. The Prime Minister acknowledged that they are breaking a manifesto promise, but said in their defence they didn't know there would be a pandemic. Which is true, but when they don't seem to be aware of anything, it's not really much of an excuse, is it? There was already a £3.6 billion deficit in social care before the pandemic, so it's a bit like me saying the reason I didn't give my friend back their book is because I didn't know there would be a pandemic on, when I've now had it for 10 years and I've written my name in the front of it saying Tiernan's book. National insurance will rise, but only for 1 year from 2023. And then don't worry, it'll decrease again, so phew. And there'll be a health and care social levy, which will be the same, but under a completely different name, so they can pretend it's something else. It's a lot like someone promising to stop repeatedly punching you, but then putting a shoe on their fist and saying it's okay, because they're now kicking you instead. Social care is in an absolute state, probably because its name contains two words the government are completely unable to understand. Really, we should have all agreed to change its name to something like civil tending, and they'd have been tricked into producing a plan for it much, much earlier. According to many Conservatives, what the government are doing is akin to socialism because taxes are going up to pay for public services, except it's only the taxes of those on the lowest wages, and I don't really remember the call for workers of the world to unite, it being just to cover the bills for those who have to spend their money going to space and exploiting people. The money won't even go to social care until enough has gone to easing pressure on the NHS first, pressure that's been exacerbated by the NHS having to do all the social care that there's no social care funding for, and it sounds a lot like one of those goofy cartoons, you know, where he keeps trying to stop a leaky pipe by putting his finger over another hole, which then causes water to spurt from another hole, and then he keeps putting his finger on that one, then water comes from another one, and all the while, you just think, you stupid fucking man-dog Dr. Moreau hell creation, why not turn the water off and invest in fixing the pipe properly? Oh, and how does this work with Pluto also being a dog? Why will no one ever explain that? Boris Johnson admitted that the poorest would be hit by this plan, but that everyone would benefit, which, yes, is exactly the problem. Only 1% of voters like the idea, which means I suppose 99% don't, and where have I heard that statistic before? But that does also mean that it's as popular as Change UK were in the 2019 election, and hopefully will get buried just as quickly. It had only a day's debate in Parliament and was voted through by a majority, and the health and care levy bill will be rushed through in a day as well, just in case someone has time to notice just how unhealthy and uncaring it is. The triple lock pension is also going to be scrapped for a year, which Work and Pensions Secretary and Dustbin Werebear Therese Coffey said was to make things fair, a term that she only uses to mean that it's all rigged worse than a coconut shy, so absolutely no one can win. If you've been hit by the national insurance rise, the triple pension lock scrapping and the universal credit uplift being cut, then don't worry, as Therese Coffey says you can recoup that £20 loss by just working 2 extra hours. Yeah, I'm sure if you ask nicely, you could just sit in a darkened restaurant or close till in the early hours of the morning and that somehow they'd pay you a better wage than all the other hours of work just for that. I'm not sure why no one's thought of that before. Maybe if everyone just worked 24/7 and never slept or went home, then companies would just keep increasing the sort of wage rate as you survived week on week like a driven zombie, and you wouldn't lose out on the triple lock pension as you'd be dead from exhaustion long before you made it that far. Coffey was insistent that people can just get a better job, but sadly, not everyone is her sister, meaning they can't just land a gig as parliamentary secretary. I'm not sure what better jobs Coffey thinks exist, or what would happen to the other jobs if absolutely no one did them, but I do really hope the cleaners she definitely employs call her soon to clean up her own piss as they heard her quote and decided to become corporate lawyers overnight. Sajid Javid too has said there are currently record jobs vacancies, which shows how out of touch he is, as most people now use streaming. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the only person on the planet who survives purely on voices crying out in terror, has been having secret meetings with a billionaire Tory donor, but insists that she hasn't breached ministerial code in exactly the same way as she did it last time. No, not the bullying, the time before that one. Both her and the business secretary, and exactly how you'd design a clown costume to parody the City of London, Kwasi Kwarteng, attended a meeting between a hotel magnate and a British Airways executive without any civil servants present, which is in breach of parliamentary rules. Though I wonder if actually all these people just don't want any witnesses, so that they willingly met with Patel in case it ruins their reputation as a human being. When she wasn't breaching parliamentary rules, Patel has been thinking about breaching international ones by insisting the UK will send back boats of vulnerable people to French waters if they arrive on our shores. Not only is that really grim and awful, but it's also only acceptable if it's done by standing on our beach with large signs saying, "Save yourself from our plague island, turn back now." I am, of course, joking. The pandemic is over. Afghan refugees arriving in the UK are being left without access to basic sanitary products, nappies, toothpaste or medicine, and put in temporary accommodation with no access to cash, which is at odds with the government calling the relocation scheme Operation Warm Welcome. But then again, you can't complain that they aren't treating them exactly the same as British citizens in need. Meanwhile, in opposition town, Labour leader and sad fart into a strong gale, Keir Starmer, is going to publish a 14,000-word mission statement to Labour members on the eve of the party conference later this month. I imagine it will read not unlike the Apple Terms and Conditions Agreement and be just as interesting. It will supposedly set out what he believes in and what he stands for, so I guess it needs to be that many words so he can add maybe, possibly, I'm not sure, and only in certain circumstances depending on what the government's stance is after every single bit. Starmer has been ridiculed for this, with many saying absolutely no one's going to read it, and that is slightly unfair, as most party manifestos are even longer than 14,000 words, and hey, no one reads those either. But at least there's usually a three-word slogan that can go on a backdrop that everyone remembers when glazing over as some MP explains all the things they won't be doing in a year's time. Labour did jump ahead in one YouGov poll last week, proving that voters hate paying taxes even more than they hate other people, and the party came out with a policy to tax landlords to pay for social care instead of a national insurance rise. Yes, an actual policy. But they also won't back a rent cap, so that'll just mean tenants have to pay more per month, not unlike a health and care levy, just under a different name so no one would notice. I'm really starting to wonder if Labour's whole strategy is just taking a leaf from the Brexit campaign, whereby the Conservatives have bad policies, so maybe if they have no policies, voters will find it preferable. In other news, Boris Johnson has said he wants to be Prime Minister for longer than Thatcher did, which might be tough considering people are already saying the national insurance rise is like the poll tax, and he'd already upset a whole ton of miners before he took the job when he left their mums. Both he and the Chancellor and smart model for the Venom films, Rishi Sunak, visited the British Gas Training Academy in Leicestershire, probably on account of both being experts in gaslighting and pumping out a lot of hot air. British Gas have been firing experienced staff who wouldn't accept a lower paid downgraded contract, and the government is advocating replacing them with low to not paid apprentices. Still, I suppose it must hearten people like Johnson and Sunak to see others doing jobs with a similar lack of expertise or knowledge as they have at theirs. The government's environment agency is allowing polluting companies to dump sewage that hasn't been properly cleaned into rivers and the sea. I do hope the next time Johnson talks about being environmentally conscious is referred to as his rivers of shit speech. And Ugly Magic 1 Jacob Rees-Mogg took a trip on the world's fastest zipline while wearing a three-piece suit. I suppose by being propelled rapidly downwards without any control over its direction, he might finally have an understanding of how the country has felt for years. Lastly, recordings have been found of Chancellor of the Duchy and bookworm that only reads Anne Rand, Michael Gove, saying racist slurs in his 20s. So I guess that's him as a shoo-in for the next Home Secretary. Ah well, at least the pandemic's over, right? Right? Holler at the Parpol Broads! It is another one of these things. And this week it is almost a normal-sized episode because, hooray, some work fell through. No, I mean, wait, boo. Or yay. I don't really know anymore, but I'm quite enjoying sitting down. I mean, it's not quite a normal episode this week, in that this bit contains 87% less waffles. I have absolutely nothing of interest to tell you this week. Absolutely zero. Which is, to be fair, I suppose, no different to normal weeks, but, you know, I still managed to fill this admin bit in. Anyway, don't know. It's just nice talking, isn't it? Not that we talk about it. I'm going to stop. So let me skim through the important bits, which is, of course, thank you for still being here. I mean, obviously, you went away and came back in between episodes. I hope you haven't just been sort of sitting completely still till this one came out. That would be weird, probably quite uncomfortable the week in between them. Anyway, big shouts to Not So Purple Aki and somebody for the Ko-fi donations, which I'm not plugging the Ko-fi anymore, but it's still there. It still exists. If you fancy donating to the podcast, please instead go to the patreon.com/parpolbro and join that. And if you really don't want to commit to sending me like £1 every month, then the Ko-fi is still lurking within the pod links. Obviously, if you can't afford to donate at all, or you just don't want to, as frankly, you can get the same ear input for free by pushing a Q-tip in too hard. Oh, no, wait, you'd have to buy a Q-tip, so not free. Don't use a free one. Anyway, if you can't donate or don't want to donate, then I shan't be offended. If, however, you send me pictures of you doing the Running Man dance, then I will be offended. No one needs that in 2021. The other thing is that next week there might not be a show at all, or there might be an interview only show. I'm not sure yet. I am actually going to be on holiday, sort of. I mean, it's a week away with friends who also have a toddler, so it's not really a holiday, is it? It's a sort of like we've moved, being stressed somewhere else. I'm hoping there's going to be at least 10 minutes each where we all get to sit in a quiet room and maybe stare at the wall, but who can say? But yeah, obviously, I'm aware this podcast has been on a holiday, even though I wasn't on one, so it's not really fair to you lot to just then suddenly have a holiday while you've got back into listening to this. But I'll try put something out if I can work it out, or if I can get an interview fitted in this week. I'm not going to have time to write all the jokes, and then the following week will probably be only jokes because I won't have had time to do an interview. I warned you last week, didn't I, that this month is sort of like half effort podcasting, I suppose. Half effort, quarter effort. Third effort podcasting. Maybe I should do it like the National Insurance Rise and just sort of increase your input, and then you can contribute to save it due to my lack of care. Would that work? I'll try it. I need to shut up. Anyway, otherwise, just you can listen to this podcast again, I guess, just the following week, and write me a series of complaints about how it's now topically out of date. That would be fine. Speaking of complaints, this week I'm interviewing Arthur Webber about trans rights, which is a subject I have been very hesitant to have on this show on account of me being ignorant about it, but also the absolute rage that it can cause online. And also because I'm one of those idiots that I just genuinely sort of think people should be able to identify how they like and, you know, try their best to go through this shitty life however they want to. I know, I'm very naive. I do keep wondering if I even have a political stance anymore, if it's all just been distilled into, can everyone stop being horrible to each other and can't we all just have a nice time? It's not quite three words, is it? Stop dicking about? It doesn't quite work. Don't be an arsehole? That's four words. Anyway, I haven't got there yet, but look, if you are one of the hallowed listeners to this show and you've somehow got enraged at the mere thought that I may talk to someone about said issue, then please do take pen to paper, write furiously on that paper, then eat the paper, and then eat the pen, and then call a doctor. You probably shouldn't eat pens. It's not good. And in fact, instead, listen to the interview. It's really good. And there is also a bit in the middle all about the national insurance rise. Spoiler, it's terrible. Of course it is. If I was to ask you what you think the most divisive issue of recent years has been, there is a high chance that you'd reel off a long list of just about, well, everything in the world, and then remember the time that woman put a cat in a bin and that dress that no one knew if it was blue and black or white and gold. Sadly, though, rather than the trivial matters such as the dress, which was definitely white and gold, many of the biggest divisive matters of recent times have been to do with the rights of usually minority groups of people, and the idea that them being given some of their basic human rights and treated like other people will somehow diminish the rights of the people who really matter, you know, the lot who love oppressing. Why should someone else get to enjoy their life when I enjoy being horrible to them and that's my enjoyment? Why would you take that away? Why won't you let me graffiti racism and homophobic abuse on walls when it's my only creative outlet? Yeesh. You know, that sort of thing. One such group that's had a very horrific time of late, and well, always throughout time, are the trans community. Nothing is so upsetting to a loud few than the idea that someone might want to choose what kind of body they live in, strongly enough to go to the efforts to change it and identify in a way that they feel comfortable with. I'm very aware that it's not something I can comprehend, as despite my constantly shit state of being, I've never felt like my body, that is mostly composed of crisps, is anything other than the right one for me. But that doesn't mean I can't at least understand that it's not all the same for others. I mean, with their own bodies, not mine, not that my one isn't right for them. That's only ever been the case for my exes. I should also say that as someone who identifies as a podcaster, sorry, I mean a white, middle-aged, hetero male, I also can't possibly claim to speak for women who say they are threatened by the notion of trans women. But there are an awful lot of feminist groups out there that don't agree with that notion at all, and evidence that the trans community is more dangerous to the rights of women than, say, Liz Truss being the Equalities Minister, Boris Johnson being the Prime Minister, all of America, the Taliban, or, well, men identifying as men existing, is scarce at best. So, while there have been a number of guests on the show who identify as trans or non-binary, I've not actually interviewed someone about the issue of trans rights itself. And as I mentioned earlier, that is partly because I'm aware that right now, even saying those words online cause your social media account to be firebombed and the entire rest of your week spent blocking people who think there should be a policing of toilets, which I don't even understand how that would work. I mean, would I have to show my genitals and driver's licence before entering? Would the person doing it be called a private detective? So many questions. But look, this week I've done it and I had a very, very lovely chat with Arthur Weber. Arthur is a trans man, a former political candidate and a very, very funny person on Twitter. So I asked him about why trans rights is such an inflammatory issue and if any of the parties at all are supportive. Oh, and just before this starts, look, I haven't done a pod interview for this show since July, and I forgot to switch my mic setting to the proper one, and so instead it recorded through my laptop mic, and look, basically to sum it up, I sound like shit. But that is okay, as, you know, more shit than normal. Yeah, I know you said it, I know you said it first, all right. But anyway, look, that's okay, as Arthur doesn't sound shit, so please just ignore my scratchy vocals, sorry, and listen to his answers instead. Here is Arthur. Arthur, right, I've got to be up front with this interview and say that I haven't really discussed trans rights in this podcast before. We've been doing it for 5 years, which is very, it's terrible of me, really, because it's something that is an important issue. It's also something that I am passionately pro, but it's really inflammatory and I'm terrified of everyone on Twitter having a go at me for doing it. And I'm a chicken, I'm a coward. And I think one of the sort of questions that I really need to start with is, you know, I mean, I'm very aware that there have been trans people, there have been gender fluid people for a very, very long time, right? And you know, in recent history, you can think of a number of pop stars that, you know, are famous people, or, you know, there's a lot of incidents of people who have identified as trans. Why is it now that it's such an inflammatory subject that seems to make people, particularly on Twitter, unbelievably livid?
I mean, firstly, I would say you might want to extend your block list before you upload this episode just to avoid all of those nasty people. But I think some of it actually comes from the increased representation of trans people, because it was something that people could very easily ignore. They didn't know anybody, they'd never heard of anybody. So why does it matter? Whereas now, because there are, I don't want to say so many, you know, there are still many places in life that trans people are excluded from, Parliament being one that's very key. But I think the representation has increased to a certain extent people's awareness, and therefore the people that aren't particularly keen on us anyway are now going, ah, what can we do about these people? But also, like, nobody's been particularly nice to us throughout history in general. When in the few occasions we have been covered in the media prior to now, in most cases it wasn't exactly nice. So I would say that, you know, from people that I've spoken to, there was sort of a period from maybe like 2010 to 2015 where the representation was increasing, but the vitriol hadn't quite yet. And at around 2015 time, that was when things started to change. And I wasn't out at that point, I should stress. I didn't come out publicly until 2018. So although I did know, I told people in 2013, but unfortunately family issues meant that I couldn't express so publicly. So I was aware and I was keeping up with this, but this wasn't something that I was experiencing personally, because it wasn't, you know, I wasn't publicly out. So
it is, I mean, sort of public opinion polls seem to be, you know, whether or not you feel that we can trust public opinion polls on anything, people seem to be predominantly supportive of trans rights, though, in sort of all the opinions. And so, you know, and also, like, from my own sort of very limited, I should point out, I always feel this is one of those situations I know nothing about. I'm very much a cis, het, white, middle-aged man. I've got all my opinions are rubbish. But my, you know, from what I do see, a lot of the anger seems to be predominantly online, and even then, it seems to be limited to Twitter and sometimes Facebook. LinkedIn is incredibly supportive, and for some reason, most boring site in the world, but it really is. Is a lot of the sort of anti-trans and the transphobia kind of discord just online, and is there a reason for that, or a reason why that's kind of, you know, all seems to be predominantly big there?
I think, I mean, firstly, I've got to state that I'm a white dude, so you know, my experience is not the experience of the whole trans community. But, and because of that, and because most people don't tend to know that I'm trans when I'm walking around in public, I personally haven't experienced any transphobia in my day-to-day life. You know, when I go to the toilet, I don't have somebody trying to stop me going in or anything like that. And I think partially that is to do with the public's sort of lack of awareness in relation to trans men versus trans women and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So for me personally, it is only an issue online, but it is not only an issue online. We've seen huge increases in transphobic hate incidents reported to the police. And obviously some people will argue that's just, trans people becoming more comfortable with reporting to the police because society in general is becoming more accepting. But personally, I don't believe that, given the increases of everything else too. I think in general, society is unfortunately changing, perhaps in the wrong way. But it's not just limited to online. People are particularly emboldened by the internet. I wouldn't say the anonymity of the internet, because most people are doing this under their real names. So it's not as though it's because they don't want it being associated with them. Although I did see some of them are kicking off because Katie Montgomery, who's a friend of mine, asked whether people could make a searchable list of all the people that signed the Women's Declaration, which is a transphobic declaration. And they're all kicking off saying they've doxed her. You signed it with your real names. So that's not doxing. You did it. But so I don't know. They're both quite happy to do it in their real names and make it identifiable to them, but then are annoyed when consequences are starting to come back at them. So yeah, it is largely online, but there is an in-person element to it as well, especially now that we've seen these protests that are going on outside the Scottish government that Graham Linehan for some reason has decided to show up at because he's now relevant again.
Well, I mean, relevant is it's an interesting choice of words, I think. one of the things I sort of found interesting was, because there was the Judith Butler piece in The Guardian last week, which then had bits of it subsequently removed. But she mentioned that there's a big sort of link with a number of transphobic sort of people to far right groups. And online seems to be an absolute sort of cesspool for that happening, where far right groups seem to link with every kind of, I wondered if that's something else that kind of amplifies the movement and amplifies that kind of attitude.
Yes, I mean, I've seen it documented. I can't remember the exact studies or whatever, that people have gone into far right groups and, you know, attended meetings and that kind of stuff, and they see trans rights as the wedge issue. So because a lot of people are very ignorant on it, because there aren't very many trans people, and so there are a lot of people who don't know any of us, and therefore it's much easier to therefore spread nasty propaganda about us if you don't know anybody that is. And so that's the wedge issue that they get people in with, that, you know, there are these nasty perverts or whatever that are going to take away your children, and then they can move on further and further to bigger groups of people until, you know, you're all the way down the rabbit hole. And, you know, it is, you know, very common now to see people who are transphobic using anti-Semitic tropes. So they are all very interlinked, and it does appear that, you know, once you go anti-trans, it's much easier than to go anti everything else. And the far right have seen that, they're capitalizing on that. They fund groups over here because they have seen that, you know, the anti-trans movement is particularly strong in Britain, whereas not so much in the US, which is very interesting given the, you know, the level of social progression in the US in general. So
is it something you just mentioned earlier, actually, was about the kind of issue in understanding about trans men, trans women. Is it, you know, a lot of the transphobia thing seems to be about the fact they believe it takes away women's rights and it takes away women's equality. I mean, and my sort of personal view is that, you know, you don't fix one set of equality by taking away someone else's, which, you know, it's never how rights work. You don't help someone else's rights by removing another group's. But is that part of the, you know, the reason why maybe trans men are seen differently, because men have got all the rights, you know, men have kind of got the privilege in general, and so people don't see it as a threat to the status of men, as it were, or men's rights? Would that be part of the reason to it, or is there something else?
I mean, it could possibly be, but I think in general, largely it has been a lack of representation. So people aren't aware that trans men exist in general, and the transphobes are fully aware that we exist. But the angle they decide to go is, instead of us being a danger to women, we are vulnerable women who have been exploited by the trans cult and been made to believe that we are men because we don't fit in with women, because we're autistic or we have some kind of other mental health issue. And obviously that's not true. There are autistic trans men. There are trans men with other mental health issues, but it's, you know, we are not trans men because of that. We are trans men just because we are trans. So that's the angle that they go down. So the trans women are portrayed as predators who have preyed on vulnerable young women who have then decided that, you know, the only solution to all of their problems is to become men. So which again is a horribly ableist, for one, viewpoint to have, that, you know, we can't make up our own minds, we have been duped into thinking these things. But that's the angle that they go down, Because obviously a lot of their arguments against trans women then don't work against trans men, because, you know, we're not infiltrating women's spaces because we were already entitled to them by being yeah. assigned female at birth. So, you know, they had to come up with something new, and this is the argument that they've come up with against us, which, you know, is equally horrible. So,
yeah, it really feels clutching at straws, doesn't it? So I suppose one of the most important questions I could ask you is really, what support do trans people need? And, you know, I'm sort of vaguely aware, it's obviously not my area of expertise, but I know the government updated the Gender Recognition Act. And as far as I understand, that made things harder. Has it made things worse?
Well, they were supposed to update it to make it easier, but they haven't actually really done anything besides they've dropped the cost and have... They've apparently made the system online. Unfortunately, I was planning on applying for mine last week, and then my wallet got nicked, my driving license in it. My driving license is my oldest piece of evidence. So I'm now currently dealing with the delightful DVLA to try and get some kind of letter to say that I transitioned ages ago. But yes, they haven't actually done anything. So the support that trans people need, well, there's a lot of things, really. It's not so much about... although the change in the Gender Recognition Act would be nice, most trans people don't have a gender recognition certificate, and that's not necessarily just because we don't want one. It's, you know, there are a whole host of reasons. I heard somewhere that in their estimates there are about 600,000 trans people in the UK, and I've seen stats saying that only about 5,000 have gender recognition certificates. So it's a really, really low percentage of people. So yes, that needs fixing, but that's not people's number one priority. I would say education, to be honest, is really key, making sure that inclusive education includes trans people, because obviously there was a real push to make sure that inclusive education included gay people, so that, you know, you weren't getting to secondary school and only hearing of gay people because you know, somebody's come out in the news and then all your friends start calling you slurs or whatever. So there's, you know, making sure that trans people are included from an early age in that, because that would mean that then kids don't... Well, one, people might figure out they're trans earlier, and that would be nice. You know, I didn't know the word trans until I was 14, but I told my mum I should have been born a boy when I was 7. So if I'd known back then that that was a thing, then maybe, you know, things would be different. But so, yeah, education is really key, both for trans people and for the people around us, so that maybe they would not bully us as much. That would be really nice. In healthcare as well, it's not even just sort of getting referrals to gender clinics and overhauling that whole system, but also just educating GPs on, you know, what being trans entails, what being trans actually affects and what it doesn't. Like, I don't know if you saw a viral Twitter thread from one of my friends called Sammy, who rang NHS 111 about a broken shoulder, and they were going back and forth on what genitals does she currently have, because they need to know in order to advise her on her broken shoulder. It's something in the trans community we call trans broken arm syndrome, whereby everything in relation to being trans is used by GPs and healthcare providers. It's because you're trans. It has to relate to that in some way. So getting rid of trans broken arm syndrome would be really, really nice. And then, you know, also just helping GPs and nurses stuff have some common sense. Like, every time I go in for my testosterone shot, my nurse goes, how long are you going to be on this for? It's the same guy every single time. It's been the same guy for the last year. And every time I go in, I have to be like, well, my brain's not going to magically produce testosterone, mate. Like, I'm going to be on it for my whole life. So just, you know, it's just very frustrating and very annoying to have to deal with that all of the time. As I say, it's been every single time since this guy took over my shots. So it's like,
wow.
Every time I have to go in, I have to brace myself. But I'm going to have to deal with Robert today, and I'm going to have to tell him yet again that my brain will not become, you know, like that. It's very annoying. And then
incredibly frustrating. Yeah.
And then also, in terms of the workplace, I'm lucky that my workplace is, they knew I was trans before I started. So there wasn't a problem in terms of, one, you know, I didn't have a passport until recently, so I wouldn't have been able to prove my right to work in the UK without outing myself. So there needs to be some sort of system in place that, you know, the trans people shouldn't have to out themselves starting work somewhere if they haven't updated their documents yet. I think that's wrong. But then also, because we are such a niche minority, a lot of HR and stuff don't understand what is transphobic and what isn't. So you can't then go and report stuff to them. So that's quite irritating because you're then having to explain to HR why this is bad when they should already know. Because for other minorities, they will have been much better educated on them and then perhaps will understand. Whereas for lots of incidences with trans people, you are then having to explain how to look after you. And, you know, I don't have a degree in being trans. I don't have a PhD in gender. I'm just a person. Like, I shouldn't have to spend my whole life educating people on how to look after me. So I think in general, obviously I started with education, but just please learn about trans people so I don't have to be a walking encyclopedia of testosterone and genital surgeries and all of that kind of stuff. Because every single trans person I've ever spoken to has had the same experience of they have to sit down with their GP and explain what they have to do. They have to sit down with their employer and explain why something that happened to them at work is transphobic. And it's just, please Google. Like,
yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, I at a completely different, very minor level, I have to constantly explain that I do know how to take my insulin despite being diabetic for 36 years. And I find that irritating. So I can't imagine how frustrating it must be for you at that next, you know, that much greater level.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We'll be back with Arthur in a minute, but first, who likes paying taxes? Yeah, sort of. I mean, I don't, but also I do. And I'm fucked if I ever want to live in a world where it's up to me to tarmac the bit of road outside our flat. Well, actually, it wouldn't be up to me, because it's not my flat. It'd be our landlord. And actually, the thought of him having to do it is quite funny. Sorry, I've gone on a tangent. Look, what I mean is I'm mostly a fan of the whole we pay tax, it funds public services, then public services work, and then we can all use them when we're ill, want to go places or lie in a park or want to go to a park to lie in it because we're ill. Those things. Obviously, I still hate doing my taxes. I'm not a weirdo, and I don't really love it when it leaves my savings account, but mostly I get sad that instead of making things better, my taxes now go towards Dido Harding's failed electric monorail scheme or nuclear missiles off the coast of Scotland. Though again, I have to say, Dido Harding running a nuclear missile scheme would be worth it, as that'd easily be the quickest way to nuclear disarmament that this country has. So really, the very idea of us all paying more national insurance and that going towards a strong social care system should fill me with delight. But of course, it's this government who they tell you they're bringing you a 5-tier cake and you know that it would turn out to be a urinal one and you'd have to pay 3,000 times the cost for it because their mate is the CEO of the company that makes them. This national insurance rise is bad. There you go, straight up, it's bad. It's because the way national insurance works unfairly favours those on high wages in the very first place. Shock and horror. If you earn between, let's get some numbers in, £9,564 and £50,268 per year, you pay 12% of your earnings to national insurance. But as soon as you earn over that amount, the amount that you pay only increases by 2%. So the more you earn, national insurance makes a smaller and smaller dent in your pay pack. So, bear with me here for a minute while I pretend to remotely understand anything about math other than it's full of positives and negatives. A 1.25% percentage rise in national insurance means people will be paying 10% more out of their pay packets. For example, if you get £1,000 a month and then pay 12% of it on national insurance, that's £120. The 1.25% increase means you'll now be paying £132.50 a month, which is a 10.4% increase on what you paid before.
People earning over £100,000 a year will pay about £1,130 extra than what they do now. But people on £30,000 will be paying an extra £255, which proportionally is a ton more of their wages. Oh, God, that was a lot of numbers, wasn't it? Sorry, everyone. But to summarise, which is also maths, the less you learn, the more this is going to dick on your parade. Meaning those earning lots won't really notice the difference and can still go and be ill in the park. But for everyone else, it's going to be quite shitty. If you're one of them younger people who have a student loan, you're going to find it particularly hard, as National Insurance plus tax plus student loan is now going to be over 40% of your wages. Still, as long as you don't spend the rest of your money on avocados and lattes, I'm sure you'll be able to afford a four-bedroom home all by yourself in no time. So altogether, the tax on earnings is going to be 2.5%, but the tax on dividends is going to be just 1.5%, and the tax on rents or interest income is still a big fat zero, in line with just how much the renty estate contributes to society. A lot of the people who work in the social care system, this national insurance rise is supposed to contribute to, whenever it finishes funding the NHS that hasn't been given enough funding, they will be paying lots out of their already minimal and hard to survive on pay packets to keep their own job alive. Which just feels like the worst situation possible. There's a job that you're probably having a really hard time at, and the only way that you get to keep doing it is if you give the money that you get from doing that job. Oh, it's like sort of the world's worst Ouroboros. It's a lot like the pay-to-play comedy model in the comedy world, where some shows say that if you really, really want to entertain an audience of mostly other bored comedians, you have to pay to do a set that you're going to hate but have absolutely no other way of getting stage time. It is usually, in that situation, only the promoter that's laughing. Comedy is such a wonderful industry. But how on earth do we fix the social care system and fund it properly if you don't rise national insurance? Lots and lots of journalists have asked, completely flabbergasted online. I mean, as a vegetarian, right, I'm not keen on eat the rich. But tax the rich is an absolutely great idea, with heaps of workable ways to do it, such as land value tax, or maybe even just taxing any fucker with a spaceship. The TUC have released a report that says an increase in capital gains tax, which is a tax on the profit you make when selling an asset that's gained value since you bought it, that, in line with income tax, would bring £17 billion into the economy. Corporation tax has been raised to 25%, but companies like Amazon are still dodging around that by being all multinational and shunting their income to Luxembourg, which I think is just too small and magical a place for money to be found there. Pretty sure it's run by mice. Has to be. And there are many other issues in place, including the main reason social care is so screwed is being down to years of austerity, which, if you remember, we also had to pay off, as that was our credit card debt that we caused by, you know, being elite bankers and gambling with it or something. I mean, I don't really remember working in the city or selling off bad mortgage debt, but maybe I was just taking up too much cocaine at the time. Also, you'd really hope that £350 million a week that the bus promised we'd get from Brexit, that would be helping the NHS right now, meaning the national insurance rise could go to social care straight away, but of course, the pandemic, which is now over or something. I can't see those rich getting taxed anytime soon, can you? I mean, how will they fund Boris Johnson's wallpaper needs if they are? Hopefully, what I'm hoping is people will just kick off poll tax style about this, and it'll be the death knell of this government, because while 130,000 people needlessly dying doesn't really bother the British public, having to pay more tax is right up there with the cost of beer increasing, which it also is, thanks to Brexit. Sorry, I mean the pandemic. I mean, Brexit, oh, it's very confusing. Only 1% of voters are happy with this national insurance hike, which means it's the 99% once again proper miffed off. All I'm saying is I better make my landlord cough up soon, or I'm going to be delivering him a bag of tarmac and expecting him to get started pretty sharpish. And now, back to Arthur.
I was going to say, the interesting thing about education is that I do find that, you know, and I do a lot of work with children's comedy, the kids are so much more switched on to the whole idea of transgender fluidity than, and do you know, people that I know that have kids, especially sort of young secondary school, late, they've got various kids in their class that identify differently, and it's just totally cool with them. And it this very much feels like a generational, or there's a generational divide in being able to understand.
Yeah, 100%. And it's like, it's obviously, I like to think of myself as still quite youthful. And so it's been a very quick changeover. I remember I went to one of my sister's parents' evenings at the same school that I went to. And, you know, I had teachers laughing at me for coming out as trans when I was at that school. I had teachers telling me that, you know, if their kids came out as gay, they'd disown them and all of that kind of stuff. And literally five years later, there's a whole section in the library on how to look after trans people and, you know, what it means to be gay, same-sex families, all of that kind of stuff. And I'm sitting there going, wow, you know, in the, I think it was five years difference, whatever, they've completely turned this round. Because I remember being at school and one of my friends who was a trans woman having to fight with the school to be allowed to wear a skirt to sixth form. And even though her parents were completely supportive and, you know, there was no issue there, the sixth form was still like, No. Whereas now, like, I hear from my siblings about, you know, their friends that have been, you know, they've had no problem in being allowed to use the right changing rooms and all of that kind of stuff. And it's been such a quick turnaround that I think it's quite incredible, to be honest.
That is incredible. It's incredible. And you know, obviously compared to some places, Britain might be better, but in general, we, you know, as we're saying, the government haven't really done anything with Gender Recognition Act. Are there other countries that are doing it much better than us? Are there other places that have made things easier for trans people, or is the whole world doing this at a similar pace?
Pretty much everywhere.
I mean, some places are way behind. So yeah,
for pretty much everywhere, does it better than here? Unfortunately, like in Malta, you've been able to have non-binary passports for years. In some other countries, like non-binary people have been able to get married just as non-binary. And they haven't needed to do any kind of legal process or whatever. They just change the words, not a problem. So for some reason in the UK, we are really far behind, and people like to, you know, go back at me and be like, oh, but the Gender Recognition Act was progressive at its time. And I have to be like, well, not really. Tony Blair had to be dragged by the European Court of Human Rights to even do it. And so it's the bare minimum. It's not, you know, it's not that New Labour decided we love trans people, we're going to make everything so easy for them. It's that actually they had to be dragged kicking and screaming to give us any kind of recognition whatsoever. So it's, you know, the UK is really far behind in terms of everywhere else. And that's why, you know, when people say about, you know, reforming the Gender Recognition Act to make it more self-identification rather than having to provide the years and years of evidence and stuff, people can quite easily turn around and go, well, everywhere else already has self-ID and they've had no problems. So it's literally just the UK that we have this issue. So, yeah, for some reason, we are really far behind. And I do think that is because, unfortunately, we have a media and we have a political class that are in their own bubble and all don't like trans people. So we've ended up with no way to change that. But yeah, I don't know why the UK, you know, it's not as though we, you know, have any kind of other issues that might mean we're particularly drawn back. But for some reason, this is the case. And I don't know how to fix it.
Like so many things, because we're shit at all of these things. That is why, isn't it? And everything gets turned as a part of the culture war and overall kind of fight for this conservative ideal world that we're never going to live in. You sort of mentioned there about the political parties being sort of very transphobic or you know, against the idea. And are any of the political parties, the British political parties, should say, supportive of trans rights? I mean, I know obviously Conservatives, I know there's issues with Labour. I know Green Party have just had Sian Berry leave recently or step down because she said there are issues there. Are any of them supportive at all or close to being? Is there any hope anywhere with any of them?
I should preface this with being that we planned this interview ages ago, so it is not that we have decided to do this because I resigned from the Labour Party a few days ago. Just because when I mentioned, when I was at work and people are like, oh, what are you doing this weekend, literally half an hour after I'd sent in my resignation, I was like, oh, I'm appearing on, you know, a political podcast, and they were like, have you planned this? And I was like, no. I did not make a particular MP go on a transphobic tirade and then the Labour Party decide to put someone under investigation for defending trans people. Like, no, this is not some big scheme to get me loads of attention. I've heard the Scottish Greens are quite good. Lots of trans people that are in Scotland have defected from the Scottish Labour to the Greens, and that they seem to be fairly good on it. But in terms of entire political parties, not really. Obviously, we don't expect the Tories to be very good on anything, to be honest. The Lib Dems, I don't really know that much about them. I probably should, because they are, you know, they're my local councillors here and things, but they put the thing through the door, I put it in the bin, but that's my engagement with the Lib Dems. So and then obviously the Labour Party is just getting worse, so I've had enough. So, and then the Green Party of England and Wales, they have a guy running for leadership entirely based on a gender critical platform, but his conference motion was defeated, and so I don't understand why he thinks that he will now get elected to be the leader of the party solely based on the same thing when he couldn't even get something passed at their party conference. But you know, so no, all of them have a problem. I know people that left Plaid Cymru over it as well, so it's just it's everywhere. You cannot escape.
Wow. And a DUP? No, I'm only joking.
Foster's going to come out as pro-trans now that you've said that.
That would be, I genuinely don't think anyone would cope. That would be the weirdest, most unlikely thing that could possibly, that's like a mock the week. What's the most unlikely thing that could ever happen? And what one of the things that really, and as I said, I've got very limited knowledge on this. And so one of the things that I filmed very confusing was the whole, the government and many major companies leaving Stonewall's diversity program. And some people said it's because of their pro stance of trans rights. Some people said it was about that they went back on their stance of trans rights. And it seemed to be a very confusing area that had quite a lot to it. And is it quite a big thing? You know, is it more simple? Could you explain it to us in an easy way? Because I know there are legal issues to it and all sorts of things. And I wasn't sure if it's just, is this a bad thing that these companies are doing for leaving, or is it a lot more nuanced than that?
I mean, it is a bad thing that they're leaving. The Stonewall is the UK's leading charity in relation to LGBT plus rights in general. Unfortunately, until recently, Stonewall weren't that great on trans rights, which is possibly why the companies are only leaving now when they've previously been part of it, because Stonewall didn't have any trans trustees or anything like that until very recently. So it is a recent turnaround. But actually, Stonewall have more members of their diversity program now than they did a year ago. It's just the ones that are leaving are kicking up a big stink about it. And obviously they are particularly important organizations, whether it be in the government and Ofcom and other things like that. So, you know, it is worrying that these are the organizations that are choosing to leave, but they are not representative of UK organizations as a whole, because more and more are actually signing up to be a part of this program.
That was much clearer than anything I've read. Thank you. Brilliant. Thank you. I really appreciate you coming on. As I said, I'm sort of aware I've been really, we have had trans people and people who are gender fluid on the podcast, but not specifically discussing this issue, because I said I've been quite cowardly about putting it out. So I really appreciate you having the time. And we didn't plan this to time with you leaving Labour Party. And if we had, that would make me a lot more professional than I actually am. So I should have pretended that we had done it. It was an incredible timing moment. But the one last thing that I wanted to ask you about is simply that I ask every interview on this, which is who are the people, the sites, the charities that listeners should go to when it comes to correct information about trans rights, or who should they be supporting, or just who are the people that you go to for political info? You know, who can you give us?
In terms of organizations, Gendered Intelligence are really good because they're run entirely by trans people for trans people. So it's not, you know, people that are having to learn about us and then talk about us. It's people that have lived experience of it. So if you want to go and look into them, they also do a youth camp for young trans people, which is really cool. And I've always wanted to go. So maybe one day I'll become a trustee of there, and then I'll be allowed to go climbing with all of the other trans people. And that'd be great. So there's them. In terms of places that perhaps you can donate to, because you've listened to this and gone, oh my God, this is awful, I would recommend looking into 5 for 5. And that's an organization where you give money to them, because, you know, that's how charities work. And then they divvy it out between a certain number of causes for trans women in particular, rather than trans people as a whole. And obviously, as we know, trans women are particularly marginalized. So looking into 5 for 5 is probably a good idea. I've donated to them myself. And they're particularly good. In terms of people in general, Sean Fay recently has a book out called The Transgender Issue. I haven't read it myself because I'm terrible at reading. The only thing I've read in like the last 2 years has been Diamonds Are Forever by Ian Fleming. So they're two very distinct, different categories of book. But Sean's book has fantastic reviews. It's top of the charts at the moment, so I would recommend looking at that. There's also Transgender Marxism, if you are particularly left-wing. That might be worth looking into, because obviously that comes from a, you know, much more left-wing argument of why trans rights are important and why we need to liberate trans people in order to benefit the working classes and all of that kind of stuff. Again, haven't read it myself, but, you know, that kind of thing. And just looking into Sean Fay in general, probably a good idea. They're just looking into, you know, trans people who are at the top of their game in whatever sort of area you're looking into. If you love, you know, sport and football, Grace Robertson is a good friend of mine, and she does a weekly newsletter about football, and it's great, and I love that. Paris Lees is a very prominent journalist. Juno Dawson has several books. My friend Finn Games has a book on trans male lower surgery, that if that's a, you know, if that takes your fancy, go and have a read of that. I did actually read that one. I could sit through it. So I hope no one compares that to Diamonds Are Forever now, because again, they are very different books.
I think it's quite an endorsement, to be fair, that you've read that and those. I think that really sells it.
But yeah, there's a lot of transmedia coming out right now. One of my friends, Harry Taylor, is currently writing a book. So I'm hoping that that will come out shortly too. So that there's a lot of media out there at the moment that you can engage in if you're wanting to learn something new. There's also loads of people on YouTube that talk about trans issues a lot. My friend Katie Montgomery, that I mentioned earlier, she has a YouTube channel, and she does a weekly thing called Turf Wars, where she talks about all of the various drama that's happened in during the week. So if you're wanting a, you know, a weekly catch up on everything they've decided to come out with this week, then you can look into that. If you're looking at more, you know, trans male side of things, Jamie Rains, I think his last name is, he's great and is very informative on that kind of stuff. So yeah, there's so much that I could write a million thing long list of recommendations of people to look into, because personally for me, though, even if it's not an area that I'm interested in, I like to follow other trans people because I like seeing them be successful. So, you know, I can see people writing about stuff and be like, I know nothing about this, but I'm going to click on this because I think you're great. So, you know, I could go on forever on this, much like the diamonds. So...
Many thanks to Arthur for the chat. You can find him on Twitter at Bernie Tranders. And of course, all the places and people he recommends will be up on the website post for this episode at some point in the future. Near future, that is, not like sort of 2064. They'll have too busy with robots then. If you've got other guests or political topics you'd like me to interview someone about, then please give me a bell, or rather don't give me a bell. My daughter will use it. I'll never get a moment's peace. So instead, email me on partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. And that's all for this week's Partly Political Broadcast podcast. If you enjoyed, or at the very least didn't hate that, then why not skip watching your favourite game show where people with money take on arbitrary tasks in order to raise money for a charity that they could just give money to in the first place, and allow something more interesting to take up the programming time with instead. And why don't you recommend this show to other fellow human beings or super intelligent animals? Join up to the patreon.com/parpolbro and maybe even leave us a nice sparkly review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere too. Thank you very much to Acast, Cat Day, and my brother The Last Skeptic. This might be back next week, maybe, when the government U-turn and replace British passports with vaccine ones, as post-Brexit they're now accepted in more countries. Bye! This week's show was sponsored by Teresa Coffey's top job finding tips, including such tips as be related to me, just already have money so you don't have to worry, get parachuted into a safe seat so you never have to make an effort, or always be on hand as an extra for an Ewok movie if they need one that looks like it's gone through a combine harvester several times.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.